What's up, you guys? Welcome back to another episode of the Seltzer Time Podcast. It's your boy Ricky, aka Dick Check, aka the man behind the can at Seltzer Time Official. Here, as always, with my conversation accomplice, the man with the hunch about Worcester, Travis.
What is cracking, Fizzle Fiends? Welcome back to another episode of the Seltzer Time Podcast. And per usual, we are stoked that you are here. This week on the show, we have a very special guest. We are talking to Robin Kennedy, candidate for Mass State Senate and the chief operating officer for the YWCA. We've had a little bit of a history, recent history with Robin, and we've been super excited about this interview. Robin, thank you very much for joining us.
Absolutely. I've been super excited to join you as well.
Excellent. Excellent. So the reason that I'm kind of like teasing this off the top is because this all started because we did a favor for a friend, and then it kind of like went from there, which is fun because that's, you know, it proves that we have people's attention, that people are paying attention to what we're doing. And that's exciting. And it's kind of new to me, if I'm being honest. So our friend Jenny is working with the Joe Petty campaign. She asked us to make a quick video because she needed social media content. And that's what we did. We made a quick video talking about Joe Petty. Didn't really talk about politics, but it basically came out as an endorsement. And then Twitter came back and said, hey, how come you haven't talked to Robin Kennedy? Robin Kennedy's friggin' sweet. You should really talk to Robin Kennedy. And kind of went from there. So here we are, Twitter. We're talking to Robin Kennedy, and we're going to learn all the cool things she's doing and why she's running for state senate.
Absolutely. And as you mentioned, as a first-time candidate, and not an avid Twitter user, this is all new to me too. So I'm super appreciative of my supporters out there that encourage the connection, and certainly appreciate you welcoming me into your space to have this conversation.
Hell Twitter yeah. Can be the best thing, and it can also be the worst thing in the world.
But it brought us together, so we'll consider it the best exactly. thing at the moment.
Yeah, exactly. Ricky only talks in absolutes. And I also do, before we get too far from it, want to give a special thank you to Miss Tina Zlody, who decided to take it upon herself to spur this interaction and introduction. So thank you, Tina, for introducing Robin and for getting this going.
Absolutely.
So, Robin, you are running for state senate for the Harriet Chandler seat that is now open. Why? Seems like a lot of work.
It is. It's a lot of work, but it's a really big opportunity. It's an open seat. So it's really an opportunity for anybody who wants to run. Now at this point, signatures are in and names are on the ballot, but it's a really a good opportunity for anyone who wants to run, who thinks that they may have something that they can offer to jump in. And, you know, we can't sit on the sidelines sometimes. We've got to jump in and get involved. And I've had a lot of experience working in state government, both for former Lieutenant Governor Tim Murray at Augustus years ago when he was a state senator, worked in the Senate directly, worked in the executive branch, and really, you know, coming full circle with the last 5 years working in the community at the YWCA, and particularly through the pandemic, really have, you know, a new perspective and the importance of what our leaders in government can and should be doing to really lift up the work of our community and really turn the innovations that we're producing and turn those into systemic change.
Love that. I love how you said you can't sit on the sidelines. That's like my favorite sentence ever.
Yeah.
I feel like it's the easiest thing to do, just to be like, oh yeah, we should do something about this. And then like kind of look around and hope somebody else does it. So it's pretty awesome that you were like, no, I'll do it. I'm just going to dive right in.
Absolutely. And, you know, I will say too, you know, Senator Chandler has just been a legacy and a legend for so many reasons. You know, it's today, even today, she's, you know, you call her, she's involved with the community, she's getting up every day to do what needs to get done to support the community, to lift up the community. And I'd say, which an important piece of that, which we need to be mindful of, she does that to lift up every member of the community, which we can definitely get into a much bigger conversation around. But she's also, you know, a legacy in the sense that she's the first female that was elected from our delegation. And the reality is the numbers of women in representation in the state legislature are going down. They peaked at 32%. Now they're back down to 30%. And so, you know, we need more women representing us. We need more diversity. We need more women and people of color at the table and leading these conversations. So I think that's incredibly important. And that's definitely something that I'm hearing from a lot of folks in the community.
Absolutely. Couldn't agree more, honestly.
We were big fans of Senator Chandler. She was gracious enough to rip a seltzer for us for social media one time.
She did.
That's awesome.
So like, but to me, that showed that she was approachable. Granted, we were talking about something.
It was a Galentine's Day.
That's what it was. It was Galentine's Day. But so it fit her whatever, her MO. But it was still cool enough that she would do some community-focused thing just for some people. I don't know. It was cool.
She's the best.
No, absolutely. And that's, you know, that's another piece of it is, you know, having leaders who are in the community, who are doing the work in the community. You know, that's such an important piece of it. It's, you know, being able to talk about the policy, talk about the 30,000 foot view. It's another thing that to really be on the ground, rolling up your sleeves and, you know, doing that work. You know, perfect example, we talk about, you know, equity, and during the pandemic, one of a very specific focus, you know, there's all the health disparities that were exacerbated and highlighted during the pandemic, but we saw it head on with the, when the vaccines became available and who was and who wasn't accessing vaccines. And I was, you know, proud to be part of a group that helped organize vaccine equity clinics. And there were many nights at the YWCA where we stayed open till, you know, 8, 9 o'clock to make sure that people of color, people that were working, you know, first and second shifts that didn't have a chance to get out between 9 and 5 to go to get a vaccine, had access, had deliberate, intentional access to receive it. And so, you know, I was able to organize some of my coworkers to be able to help staff the vaccine clinics, help kind of get people checked in. Then of course the doctors were administering the vaccine. But to me, that's the important part of it is doing the work, is showing up, as well as talking about why things like that, why centering equity is so important.
I would agree. I think there's a lot of people in the community that do it or do things performatively where they love showing and shining the light on themselves, saying that they're doing the good, but when it comes down to it, they're not actually rolling up their sleeves like you're suggesting. So I too will stand beside any leader that chooses to, you know, get down in the dirt with their fellow coworkers. And I don't know, that was at a time where it was scary to be outside. And absolutely, there you are taking it head on, making sure that people got safer.
Absolutely. And, you know, to that, every chance I get, give a huge shout out. The YWCA never closed during the pandemic. So our childcare center stayed open throughout. And in fact, we, on a Friday afternoon in March of 2020, we closed down our traditional program. That Monday, we reopened as an emergency center for first responders, hospital personnel, big box store personnel, essential workers. And then in July, we transitioned back over a weekend to our traditional childcare program again. Our teachers kept at it. We kept asking them to do more. We opened up remote learning hubs when the schools closed down so that kids could have a space to go, so parents could continue to go to work. And you ever want to see, you know, phenomenal human beings, our staff that had 26 kids that were on different Zooms doing different from different schools in different classes, doing different lessons on different schedules. And our staff made sure that they were getting what they needed to get done. We're supporting them and supporting parents. And that is, you know, huge kudos. Our domestic violence services never closed. And in fact, we saw a huge uptick in calls and needs. Our transitional housing program stayed open. So, you know, we've been at it throughout. And so, but also, you know, we saw a lot of innovation, you know, kind of going off on a tangent here, and happy to kind of talk
the podcast. Really, that's what these work.
but we saw so many innovations, you know, we saw so many things that we knew would probably work better and just never did it. And then we had the flexibility to try things during the pandemic. And we proved what works better. We proved what we've known all along in so many ways. And that to me, you know, another reason why I'm running, to get to Boston and help make some of these, you know, systemic changes. Really address the root causes of some of the challenges we're facing. So
absolutely, that's like, it's so cool how you're saying the YWCA didn't close. You kind of, I hate the word pivot because I feel like it's like the easiest word that people throw out there, but like that's what you did. You just kind of shifted a little bit and then became such a massive resource, and it kind of sucks that like that wasn't covered more. Not that like, you, I mean, obviously you guys didn't do it for that, but like, I feel like that's something that, you know, there should have been more fanfare around, because that's such a huge, huge, huge resource. And as important as like, you know, the domestic abuse center and stuff like that, like you, those things always kind of fly under the radar when at the end of the day, they're massive, significant resources. That's extremely awesome that you guys were able to do that.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And, you know, that's my number one priority on the campaign. And my number one priority when I get, you know, to the state house is investing in the care economy. And that's everything from early education and care. That's mental health clinicians, educators, home health aides, CNAs, the entire workforce. And it's, you know, we should be noting and talking about predominantly women of color that make up these workforces that show up every day to care for somebody else. And we've just undervalued and underpaid these workforces for so long, and they've been decimated by the pandemic. There's 25 classrooms, early education and care classrooms in the city of Worcester that are closed because we can't hire and retain teachers. That's 200 slots probably that we could put into the community, but we can't hire teachers because they're getting paid working elsewhere, working at Target, working at grocery stores. And so while we look at policy to expand, you know, universal pre-K, and for me, that should get to quality, affordable care for every infant through, you know, toddler in the community. For me, we need to begin by investing in our workforces, paying our workforce what they deserve, and helping to build them back up so that they are here to deliver the services that we all rely upon.
Absolutely.
And yeah. I saw it right through the, you know, through the pandemic. I say all the time, folks clapped for us. Folks were incredibly generous, donating meals and, you know, donating supplies and supporting our teachers during the start of the pandemic. You know, the philanthropic partners we have in the community were amazing in helping us and helping us get resources and be able to pivot and adapt with what we needed. But now we need to really show our gratitude. We really need to invest in the workforce. And it's across the board, like I said, every, you know, all the workforces in the care economy have just been so decimated over the last few years. And we know it's 6 months now to get a clinician or to even get an appointment. So we need to really invest in that not only the workforce, but the pipeline to build up the workforce.
But we're not like we're doing this as a favor to them, as like a thank you. This is just them getting paid what they should be paid. And there's a reason, to your point, why if they have a better financial career working at Target, there's something that should be looked at.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So for a couple knuckle draggers that really don't know much about politics, like you, I support you wanting to get to the state house and to bring change and to bring a younger perspective and a new way to look at these issues. Is that something that's actually feasible? Like, you know, as somebody from Worcester, like, can we really affect change? Is it going to be slow moving like most government? Yeah. What does the state senator do, I guess?
Now, and so yes, in a couple different ways. And, you know, I had the opportunity to work in the Senate and to really see this firsthand. And to answer your question, there's two very real ways in which a senator can be effective for the community. Fortunately, you know, a Senate staff is a little bit bigger than what a House staff is. So you usually are able to have someone that's particularly helping you focus on policy and focusing on legislation. But you also, if you're a good senator, have a constituent services team that's from the district, in the district, that's really working with the community. You know, when I worked for Ed, I was the constituent services aide. I was living in Worcester, and I worked, you know, I spent every week, I was in each of the different towns that we represented and talking to the constituents. And what I say, the lesson I learned from that is you know, you hear about the one person who can't get their check from Social Security. But then you start to hear that there's five people that haven't gotten their checks, and those five people are trying to get to the same office. So then you can understand that there's a systemic issue, and you can understand whether it's something, you know, working with our federal partners, if we're talking about Social Security, that we can get addressed, or as a legislator, there's legislation that can be enacted that can really, you know, push to make the changes that are needed. Now, to your first question, you know, I'd be, you know, lying, or anyone would be lying to say that you get in there day one and you, you know, are setting the place, you know, blaze with major change. And, you know, there is a hierarchy, like in any establishment of, you know, within the state Senate, within the legislature. And so part of it is having those relationships, and many of which I have from my time working there. But it's also building, taking the time to build those relationships, which does take time. That's why, you know, there is, you know, a sense that somebody needs to be in the seat for a few years to be able to get to a point. You certainly can be filing legislation. You can definitely be honing in on your priorities. The budget is a great asset where every legislator, for the most part, unless you're completely out of favor, but most legislators have an opportunity to share their priorities with the chairperson of Ways and Means and with the Senate president. So you can get some of that, you know, that was particularly from that that asset, process, bring, you know, deliver for the community. But to really get into a leadership position, it does take a few years to build up that relationships and to build up that capacity. You know, with the state Senate, which is vast majority Democrat, most senators, if not all, still, when I was there years ago, it was all senators were chair of a committee. So, you know, depends on what you get assigned, but you do have some opportunity, depending on your assignment, to control some legislation, to help move some legislation based on that committee.
And that's on the state level, not just for our district.
Correct. Right? Correct.
So you're assigned a committee?
Yes.
Okay, that's cool. I never knew that. I didn't know most of this, but interesting. I didn't know if it was like you picked it going in.
Well, and hopefully, you know, you have a relationship with the Senate president and you kind of talk about what your priorities are, and depending on where that fits with everybody else's priorities and where folks want to be, you do eventually get assigned. So it's definitely interesting. But, you know, when I worked for Senator Augustus, he was the chair of the elections committee, and he did a lot of work to just really, you know, hold hearings and to help move the conversation. Now, this was back in 2005. So we've come a long way in progress in terms of, you know, mail-in ballots, in terms of, you know, same day, which we haven't got to yet, but, you know, trying to push for same day registration, push for early voting. So you absolutely can make some difference in regardless of the committee that you get assigned.
That's cool. I don't think I ever knew that Ed was a senator.
He was. He was a two-term state senator.
That's cool.
Yeah. It was phenomenal. He's a great guy, and he was great to work for.
I hope he enjoys his time as a chancellor for a college.
Yes.
Oh yeah, I forgot about that.
I'm picturing, I mean, this is a silly aside, but I'm picturing like Revenge of the Nerds, or like, I know that was a dean that they terrorized, but picturing Ed chasing a bunch of ne'er-do-wells across the campus.
Yeah, absolutely.
Maybe on an OFO bike. So, all right. When I was asking around and asking just about, you know, what should I ask Robin Kennedy? You know, I have an opportunity. I heard one thing that I didn't really even consider. Maybe it's because I'm not from Massachusetts and I don't really have the same type of history. But what would you say to somebody that they are all set with Kennedys in state in elected positions? Because it was something that somebody told me and I'm like, oh shit, I didn't even make that correlation.
Yeah, no, it's so interesting, you know, as we talk about that, you know, that I'm running against, and, you know, it's an open seat, but I'm running against an incumbent whose name's certainly in the paper often, and folks know who he is. And so name recognition for me is the name of the game, is the battle that I'm, you know, up against. But I did, I have said, you know, having the last name Kennedy in Democratic politics, it certainly can help in getting the name out there, but certainly I know that there's a contradictory relationship with the Kennedy name and the Kennedy family. I will say this, for better or for worse, there's no relation, unfortunately. So there's
that's gonna be my question.
Oh yeah, there's my Kennedys actually came from Holyoke, Massachusetts, and my dad was raised out there, and his family's still mostly out that way. He moved out to Worcester to actually work at Jordan Marsh years and years ago. So at the Galleria, which is where he met my mom back in the 70s. So there's no connection, just the shared name. So hopefully that person might be willing to take a look at me and consider what I'm focused on and what I really wanna, why I'm running and the issues and where I stand on the issues. And hopefully they'd be willing for a conversation.
Good answer. I said, it's probably just a name, dude, but I will ask.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But no, I mean, that was a great answer. And again, that's the end of my like hard hitting questions, because I don't know. Again, I just want to support somebody that wants to support the arts, supports the culture, supports the people. And, and it's clear by your actions that you're recognizing definitely the people. We haven't really touched much on the arts and the culture. I mean, culture differently than arts, but do you have an interest in arts? Do you have is it one of your?
Yeah, no. I'm not in the arts community. And so I do recognize that, and don't, you know, one of the things that I never agree with politicians when they pretend to be something they're not, for a good kind of line. But what I'll say is, you know, I look at what's happening in the community and look at opportunities, you know, look at the Creative Hub. I mean, it's a perfect example of what is right about our community. And, you know, for all the amazing things that Laura and Stacey do and all the amazing things that they are, the way they're deliberate about ensuring that the arts are not only accessible to folks, to community, to kids who wouldn't have access to them otherwise, but that they're mindful about that equity in arts and that culture in arts and bringing out cultural identity. And you know, you see it in the different programs that they have and that they're going to have in their beautiful new space. That's what a leader should be lifting up. I shouldn't come in and say, this is what we should be doing. I should say, who's doing it really well in our community, and how do we lift them up? How do we give them a seat at the table? How are they helping us decide where the money is going and how we're supporting the community in that sense? And I do think, you know, Worcester, as much as we, you know, the renaissance that we talk about, I think we are having a real renaissance around the arts and culture. I mean, the JMAC, another perfect example, the Box Theater, other opportunities that there's, you know, the powwow, that's just amazing. And the YW, we're fortunate to have two powwow murals and another mural that our girls in our program helped to paint, the Maiden, the Mother, and Crone. And it brings life to our city. It brings life to these brick walls. And so, you know, it's something I definitely support. You know, Start on the Street, Tina Zlody talking about, you know, the amazing work. Another opportunity of, this isn't just about, you know, improving and enhancing our arts and our culture and the amazing talent that we have, but it's economic development. It's about bringing people into our community. And so, you know, I think that's, you know, there are definitely ways. And then, you know, talking about some of the towns, there is this amazing community center in Bolton called 19 Carter. And it's this old Methodist church that the community came together to renovate. And it's now this amazing community space where they have all kinds of different events there. Anyone in the community can use the space. They have regular lunches and morning coffees, and they bring in speakers. That, again, that's another example of the community doing something amazing, that it's our job as leaders to then say, let's elevate this, let's lift this up, let's help you invest in this and build it. So
I agree. Yeah. Like Ed Augustus, former city manager, used to say, the arts are the secret sauce. But it's one of those things that it's easy to say, but it doesn't always get the support. You bring up another fantastic example. I was part of the board of Powwow Worcester, and I was, you know, part of the team that brought those murals. And I got to work with Sydney James to work on that beautiful red mural. And that was that's a project that, by a lot of people's just perspective on it, it seems like it's a city funded project, but it's completely independent funded and grassroots funded. And to me, I would like to see more opportunities for, whether it's on the city level or just through these other arts organization, where it's not one, one organization controlling the murals in a neighborhood. It's instead the neighborhoods themselves controlling what murals, and if there's access to money and a way to do that. Just like innovative programs like that, where we continue to support the arts, because that art is culture, that art is representative. It's representative of the people. It's representative of where they come from or who they are as people and, you know, contributors to our community. And I think that's really, it's special. And I also have a personal vendetta against advertisements, and I want to see more walls covered in art before they're covered in billboards, but that's just my own two cents.
No, absolutely. And, you know, we have a huge opportunity with the ARPA funding that's coming in. You know, one of the amazing things about the ARPA funding that we should all be paying attention to is the flexibility and opportunity for innovation that can come out of the funding. You know, it's designed and we need to make sure that it's used for those that, you know, have been most impacted by the pandemic. And the arts community is certainly up there and included in who's been most impacted by the pandemic. And it's also, you know, about how these communities can be using this funding innovatively to best meet their needs, best expand their opportunities and services and resources. And so I think, and I know there's, you know, an ad hoc committee that's focusing on arts and culture. So, you know, exciting. And hopefully, you know, this is another good learning opportunity for government to think about how we can be more flexible and more innovative in how we're, you know, allocating funding or how we're supporting community projects.
Absolutely. I was going through your website before we jumped on, and it kind of felt like every other point was like about, I mean, I'm going to veer away from the art thing, but it was like about like kids and childcare and kind of like, I don't know if it's just because like I'm getting to the point where like we're going to probably start thinking about kids soon. And I'm like, oh, cool. This is something that, I mean, I always want children to be taken care of, but now I'm like, okay, cool. I'm going to raise a family in Worcester. Like, what's that going to look like? Because it can be kind of scary sometimes. Yeah, it was just like really cool going through and seeing that, you know, almost every, if not every other bullet point, and then like your first bullet point under priorities is like childcare. Like, I love that. And then I know like we were briefly talking about the Jane Fund, and like your support of them, and there, I couldn't say enough good things about the Jane Fund. I love everybody that's involved in that entire organization. They're the greatest.
Yeah. No, and I think, you know, first on the childcare piece, I'd say, you know, the platitude, right? But that's something I wholeheartedly believe is education's the great equalizer, right? This is the magic silver bullet. And from what I've seen at the YWCA over the last 5 years, what I've seen doing the work in the community with other childcare providers is that education should begin at birth. You know, I look at our infant teachers have a curriculum that they do with the kids, with the infants.
Really?
You know, I mean, it's phenomenal. It's not babysitting. It's early quality education. And so, you know, that should be accessible to every child in the Commonwealth. You know, there's not a single parent that I know of that I've ever met that hasn't thought about care and quality care for their children. And, you know, it's scary, but the reality is the field is going away. You know, I said there's 25 classrooms. If we don't invest in this system, if we don't build it up, not only are we not going to be able to get it a quality system, an affordable system, but we're not going to have a system to begin with. And I never want to focus on the fear, because and I know that there's so many politicians these days and that, you know, want to kind of scare people into voting or doing a certain thing. I say that because I think there's an opportunity to change course. And the legislature, they actually had a legislative commission that focused on early education and care. They came up with 14 recommendations on how to improve, how to pay providers so that providers could then pay their teachers more, how to improve the quality of the system, how to expand access for parents to the system. So there's things we can do if we're deliberate and focused on it. And it's the way to set every child up for success in the future, to have that access to that quality education for every parent that wants it for their child. And so, you know, unfortunately, you know, another place where we have to be mindful and deliberate about equity, to make sure that that families are equitably accessing these systems and accessing these supports as well. And I can tell you, it's incredibly costly for families. You know, $65 a day on average, depending on the age of the child. So, you know, it's definitely something that, you know, we need to expand. And you know, one of the recommendations and one of the pieces of legislation is setting a cap on what families pay for childcare, so that there's, you know, you're not paying more than 7% of your income towards childcare bills. So there's definitely ways in which we can, you know, fix the system, course correct, and not only improve the system. And again, I have to say it over and over again, by beginning with investing in our workforce, but then we can actually grow the system so that it's available for more children in our communities. Switching gears to your other question about the Jane Fund, yes. And I think, you know, the reason why I love them so much and why I too support them is that's a part of reproductive health that we don't talk about. So, you know, going to the leaked Roe decision, you know, those of us on the ground that have been fighting this battle, we knew this day was coming, right? They've been working towards this for 50 years now. When I was in college, I was, you know, on the front lines rallying and fighting, and have been my whole adult life, have been fighting to protect Roe, have been fighting here in Massachusetts to expand services. Senator Chandler, again, another example of, you know, with her leadership passing the Roe Act so that we're safer in Massachusetts than many, you know, most states in the country. But there's so many other layers to quality, you know, affordable, reproductive, comprehensive reproductive care that we still need to address. The affordability is a big piece. You know, yeah. Abortions can cost up to $750, and a lot of individuals don't have access to that resource. So where the Jane Fund steps in, and that doesn't even count people that have to take days off for work or have to travel to get. Stay in a hotel to for the night or something like that. So to be able to provide that support, the affordability of it, we have to be talking about, you know, and we also have to be talking about how transgender individuals don't have access to comprehensive, affirming, you know, gender affirming reproductive care. That's something we haven't yet been able to really scratch the surface on. We have to be talking about how, because of the healthcare system we have, there's much higher maternal morbidity rates for Black and Latina women. These are all parts of when we talk about, you know, abortion being healthcare, you know, talking about being pro-choice and being for reproductive care. These are all components that we need to be actively also working on.
Absolutely. I think, and that, I mean, again, that kind of ties right back into the, like, how important education is, just in educating people on the importance of, you know, not only what the Jane Fund does, but what every, you know, abortion like activists and stuff like that are doing, just to kind of educate the bare minimum, be like, it's not just what you read in the paper. Like, there's so much going on.
Right. Well, and even a misconception, you know, that you know, Planned Parenthood, 90% of the services they provide are not abortion.
Yeah.
They're providing comprehensive health care. They're providing access to other reproductive care that every individual needs. And so, you know, to be able to access those services are incredibly important. You know, access to contraception, including Plan B, incredibly important. And we're still fighting the battles to making that accessible.
Yeah. I mean, to me, a good way to spend a Saturday is driving by Planned Parenthood and telling all the protesters that they're terrible people. I mean, that's just me. I like to have fun, but I couldn't agree more. And a lot of the services, a lot of the services that they offer they fill a gap where a lot of these women don't have any other option. And the fact that we have people even positioning themselves to help these people who are in compromised positions is, I don't know, it just makes me feel better about our community.
Absolutely. And you know, the other piece of this, you know, fortunately this year we finally got comprehensive sex education in our schools. There's still not a statewide curriculum for comprehensive sex education. So another thing that legislator Cannon should be working on is to be able to make sure that every child in every community has access to that. You know, and again, another myth to dispel, it's age appropriate. It's medically accurate. Yeah. It's, you know, it's LGBTQIA inclusive and supportive. And that's what every child, you know, who's maybe not able to get that education at home. Maybe, you know, parents can opt out and can, you know, take their kids out if they want, if they're providing that education. But for every other child to be able to have access to that information, you know, we at the YWCA have a program. We haven't run it recently, but a child abuse prevention program in our preschool it begins with teaching kids how to find a trusted adult. More often than not, that's your parent, right? That's who you go to first. It's your parent or your caretaker. But if it's, you know, how to relate to adults, how to relate to each other, how to understand when something's uncomfortable. And again, it's not scary or, you know, inappropriate. It's about helping kids kind of set that framework so that as they get older and start to make decisions, you know, they're able to make, you know, educated decisions about their healthcare, about their life. And that's incredibly important.
I couldn't agree more. And after talking to you for the past half hour, it's pretty clear that we share a lot of similar perspectives on the way money and attention and work should be done. That doesn't a correct statement, but you get my point. That we want to help the same types of people. But just to kind of steer this towards more of a conclusion, Robin Kennedy, the person, because you're a very good candidate, but as a person, you're a lifelong Worcester resident. You must know, like, where can we see Robin letting her hair down, you know, on a Friday night? Where do you like to go on?
Well, it's funny. It's been a long time since I feel like it's been a Friday night out.
Respect.
Yeah, no, I just, wow, I haven't been, you know, there is so much. Worcester is so cool with so many hidden gems. You know, you, when you emailed early and mentioned kind of my favorite restaurants, you know, one of my favorite restaurants in the city is Loving Hut. I'm a pescatarian. So that's a Robin Kennedy thing. And so non-meat eater,
Loving Hut. My fiance is a pescatarian too.
Oh, there you go. There you go. Yeah. No, so I do eat the seafood, but no meat, but, you know, the food, the vegan food at Loving Hut is one of my favorite, whenever I can get over to Chandler Street, is definitely one of my favorite spots. And, you know, we have so much good music, so many cool bars and just local places that, you know, and I, you know, I'm more of a restaurant glass or two of wine at the restaurant kind of person than I am at the late night, bars these days. Respect. You know, but you same. Know, I spent,
same.
You know,
the late nights are becoming few and far between.
Exactly. Exactly. But you know, I spent my fair share of time at Leitrim's back in the college yes. days. And in addition to being a lifelong college, lifelong Worcester resident, I also went to Assumption College. So I really have, and Clark for my master's. So I'm very Worcester centric for sure. So I definitely spent some time at a lot of the local establishments back in the days, back when it was Mahoney's.
That was the first bar I ever went to when I was 21.
Really? Yeah.
Same. John handed me my first legal beer, and I was like, "Wow, this is weird."
You know what's so funny? Every time I see, or not every time anymore, but because I see him more frequently, but I used to always say that he was also this first person that gave me my first legal drink. So
he's the best.
I remember being there at midnight on my 21st birthday. So
yep, I remember. I didn't know that he sold it, and then I went in because I went in there like a handful of times when John still owned it, and then I went in after he had sold it, and it was a completely different vibe. And I was like, what happened in here? And then I saw him like a couple of days later at Starbucks. And I was like, hey, like, what, new business plan? Like, what's going on? He's like, oh, I sold it. But they're like, I don't know, they didn't change the name for some reason. Yeah. And then it made more sense why it was like a completely different place, pretty much.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And it's changed over a few more times, I think, since then.
Yeah, I don't know. It has a different name now. It's like,
yeah,
something dog related, I think. Yeah.
But even like the cool, you know, Worcester vibe, like I went to Mint for the first time.
Oh, so how is that place?
Get over there.
Amazing. Yeah. You know, I look forward to going there. Going to have, it looks like, you know, from the setup and from talking with the owner that there, you know, going to be some music opportunities. So another really cool, like just great food, great local community opening up the restaurant. And, you know, so there, Worcester has so many hidden gems like that. That's, you know, it's such a diverse place to be able to find good, you know, cultural food, diverse food. So it's really exciting.
One of my best friends and avid listener of this show would be remiss if I didn't ask you if you've been to Belmont Veg up on Belmont Street.
It's, you know, it's so funny. Every time I think to go there, it's closed.
Like, that's just like, that's their schedule. You got to work around them.
I know, exactly. First
Jamaican boys operate at a different level.
Yeah, absolutely. It's the funniest thing because I won't, you know, think about it for a while and then I'll be like, oh, you know, or someone will mention it and I'll say tomorrow, okay, I'm going to go for lunch and then they'll be closed tomorrow. So unfortunately, no, but I would love to. And I hear they have the best vegan mac and cheese.
I've heard that too.
So I do definitely want to get there. I have not.
I've been told their patties are the best, but they're always out of them because as soon as like they put them out of, feels like everybody on Belmont Street can get a whiff and they all come and buy them out before else knows about it. I don't know that for sure, but that's kind of what it feels like.
Yeah, that does seem right. Another great, you know, hiders, you know, Merriam and taking over them. Another place that's just amazing quality homemade food. And you know, I get in trouble because I go in there and I go to buy, you know, a thing of hummus and come out with $100 worth of, you know, amazing food. But
We did that the other day. My girlfriend and I went, and all I wanted to do was grab a quick snack. And I left with kebabs, lentils and rice and cauliflower, steak tips, which we had last night.
Yeah.
It was all delicious, but it was not what I intended to buy.
Yep, exactly. But
anyway. Sometimes I have to just like blow past their posts on Instagram because I'm like, I don't have time today. Like, I really can't.
Not today, Miriam.
But if I see it, I'm like, I gotta go. Say hi to Greg. It's a whole thing.
Yeah, Greg, you're getting me. Well, Robin, it has been delightful talking to you. I thank Twitter and Tina and all the everybody else for making this happen. Because agreed, people need to know who our candidates are and who they should be voting for. They should educate themselves. If they wanted to educate themselves more on your campaign, where would the best place to look?
So they'll probably find me on their doorstep. You know, my campaign has been all about knocking doors. We've knocked 4,000 doors so far, and that's where I'm spending all my time. So they'll probably, I'll probably show up and introduce myself in person. But my, if they're looking for me, which I would love to have folks just kind of see what's out there, see my positions. My website is best. It's www.kennedy4senate.com. I have all information up there about my policy priorities and areas, positions on different policy issues, et cetera. So, and certainly they can find me on Twitter at Robin4Senate. they definitely, I would encourage folks to follow me there because I'm definitely active in terms of putting out, you know, kind of policy perspectives, responding to things that are happening in the community, as well as letting folks know where I stand on issues and where I will stand on issues.
I say, I love your social presence. As a person who works in social media, it's pretty much where I spend all of my time. So if I can't find something on social media, to me, it doesn't exist. which I tell my boss every day, but I just love how active and consistent your accounts are. Just, you're killing it.
Well, thank you. And I have to say, I have a phenomenal Giselle Rivera Flores who does marketing. She's my consultant on social
don't
media.
Touch
I can't
my
take,
podcast.
It's yes. My oh, that's awesome.
Every time she posts about her podcast on Facebook, I screenshot it because I'm like, I have to listen to that, and then I forget to do it. So. I have to.
She's phenomenal, and she it's all my language, my words, but she turns it into something that I could never never do. So I certainly have to give her credit for that. And you know, I do think this is when we talk about campaigns. That's another point. You know, Giselle does amazing work in marketing, but hasn't done campaigns. For me, this is another opportunity where I can bring people in. You know, I've worked on hundreds of campaigns in my life, even though I'm a first-time candidate. And so I came into this with some experience, some knowledge of what I need to do. And I've been able to hire consultants to kind of help me set my campaign plan. So for me, it's about using this opportunity to give people space that may not have access to campaigns, may not have access to political establishment, and be able to give them the opportunity to learn. You know, hopefully I would encourage any candidate out there to hire her going forward. And now she has that political and is building that political experience as well. And that for me is incredibly important about, you know, how we walk the walk, how we are deliberate about when we talk about wanting to provide access and give space to folks, we need to do it. And so that's been really important to me when I'm building my team.
I love how you hired, as simple as this sounds, I really love the fact that you hired a marketing person to do your marketing instead of a political person to do your marketing.
Yeah.
She hired the person that started IG Worcester MA.
Yeah.
If that's not one of the most prolific local Instagram accounts, I don't know what is. So smart move.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And shout out to her and Jen Gaskin for their podcast. I too still haven't listened, but I see.
Absolutely. Yeah, no, exactly. And it's, you know, it's again, bringing women of color, you know, my team is mostly women and also representative of the LGBTQIA community. Again, it's about using these spaces that we have when we have the privilege to do so to make space and give opportunity to others to grow and to gain that experience.
Absolutely.
Hell yeah.
Love it.
Well, Robin, you have been delightful to get to know. I'm excited to learn more. I'm excited to see you out on the campaign trail. I hope all of our listeners take a moment to educate themselves. If you're here in Worcester or if you're in our district, to educate yourself on your candidates and learn a little more. maybe figure out a way to go talk to her, because apparently she's going to knock on your door.
Absolutely. And I would just add, you know, West Boylston, Boylston, Berlin, Bolton, and Northborough. If you're listening from there too, I hope to be your senator as well.
Hell
yeah. Oh, everybody in West Boylston. I grew up there. So
oh, I'm fantastic.
I'm there all the time. My parents.
He knows everybody.
Oh, excellent. Yeah. Well, hopefully I'll gain your support and support of your family and friends out in West Boylston as well.
Done.
Excellent. Thank you
and
so much.
For our listeners, thank you very much for tuning in to another episode of the Seltzer Time podcast. Find us at seltzertime.com. Find me at Hunchback Travis.
Also, if you're listening, can you please bring the three of us Belmont Veg? Because that's all I'm going to think about now.
Or at least tell me when they're open so I can go there.
Exactly. You guys can find me at DickChuck77, every platform, and then usually playing around on Seltzer Time Official. Also, every platform.
Awesome. Actions and words, people. Let's get stuff going.